On this 19th day of September 2006, we are studying Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Chapter 2, Contents of the Gita, summarized, text 21. Vedavinashinam nityam yehinam majamabhyam katam sapurushak pata kangati yati hantikam Vedavinashinam nityam yehinam majamabhyam katam sapurushak pata Kanghati yati hantikam. O Partha, how can a person who knows that the soul is indestructible, eternal, unborn, and immutable, kill anyone or cause anyone to kill? Purport. Everything has its proper utility, and a man who is situated in complete knowledge knows how and where to apply a thing for its proper utility. Similarly, violence also has its utility, and how to apply violence rests with the person in knowledge. Although the justice of the peace awards capital punishment to a person condemned for murder, the justice of the peace cannot be blamed because he orders violence to another person according to the codes of justice. In the Manu Sanhita, the law book for mankind, it is supported that a murderer should be condemned to death so that in his next life he will not have to suffer for the great sin he has committed. Therefore, the king's punishment of hanging a murderer is actually beneficial. Similarly, when Krishna orders fighting, it must be concluded that violence is for supreme justice, and thus Arjuna should follow the instruction, knowing well that such violence committed in the act of fighting for Krishna is not violence at all, because at any rate, the man, or rather the soul, cannot be killed. So for the administration of justice, so-called violence is permitted. A surgical operation is not meant to kill the patient, but to cure him. Therefore, the fighting to be executed by Arjuna at the instruction of Krishna is with full knowledge, so there is no possibility of sinful reaction.
Today I'm speaking to a lawyer, you know.
Hold on a second. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto him. Can we save it till question time? Okay. I'm sure it's very important. This verse brings to mind a verse in the 18th chapter in which Krishna tells Arjuna that if one acts without false ego, then even if he kills, he does not bear any responsibility. Yes, text 17, 18:17. Yasya naham kuto bhavo buddhir yasya nalipyate hatvapi sahima lokan nahanti nanabadyate. One who is not motivated by false ego, whose intelligence is not entangled, though he kills men in this world, does not kill, nor is he bound by his actions. So this is the same import of the verse we are reading now, that if someone is truly situated in Krishna consciousness and is aware of the difference of the soul and the body, and that the soul is really not killing, and he's acting on behalf of Krishna in the righteous war, or for the matter of justice, as Prabhupada talks here about the justice of the peace, or just the judge, then there's no responsibility for the killing. In one sense, he doesn't kill, because you can't kill the body. You can't kill the soul. So really, it is an act of a service. This is an act devoid of false ego, and therefore there's no responsibility. As it's also said, Devashi bhutata nuinam patinam nakin karo nayam runi charajan. Sarvatmana yak sharanam sharanyam gato mukundam pariritya kartam. So we come into this world full of debts. Devashi bhutata nuinam patinam. We're indebted to the devas, we're indebted to the rishis for their knowledge, we're indebted to other people and other beings in general for helping us. But all of these debts are paid if one gives up the sense of being the doer and simply surrenders unto Krishna, who is the one to be surrendered to. Sarvatmanakyak sharanam sharanam gato mukundam pariritya kartam. So giving up the sense of being the doer, this is sometimes hard to fathom, because on one hand, we're asked to do so many things, different than what we're doing now. And by doing those things, we'll cultivate devotional service, we'll cultivate a sense of Krishna consciousness, and in this way perfect our lives. And yet one of the internal aspects of that cultivation is to understand that you're not the doer, right? You're not the doer. I'm not the doer. Everybody say, I'm not really the doer. Krishna is the doer. So what does it mean? Well, in this case, the doer means the fruitive actor. To understand that we're not the doer in the sense that everything has been given unto us by the Lord, the body, the senses with which we act, the intelligence by which we know how to act, the life air, everything is a gift. So in one sense, we're not the doer. But the one thing that we do, the critical factor, is to change our motivation and change our desires about how we're acting and what we're doing. So this is the critical factor here. One who knows that the soul is eternal, one who knows that the soul can never be killed and is unborn, knows that he cannot kill, and also that he himself is not the killer. But, as Prabhupada says here, that doesn't mean that violence should be eschewed wholeheartedly or in toto, because he gives various instances when violence is justified. When there is a murderer, when someone is convicted of a murder, it's actually proper that they be executed because they have to pay for it anyway. Either if they don't pay for it in this life, they'll pay for it in the next life, and the punishment may be much worse. If you read the fifth canto, third canto, the description of hell and punishments there are far worse than some execution. Throwing down from a mountain repeatedly and being crushed, you know, in your subtle body, and then being taken up again, crushed and taken up and thrown off. Or being boiled in oil and so many different things for thousands of years. Is that better or worse than experiencing the short, terror of being executed in this lifetime? Or a surgeon, you know, the same scalpel or the same knife that can take the life can also give the life by performing an operation. So that's a kind of violence. And of course, we're on the battlefield here. So Arjuna, when he fights in this battle, in one sense, he's not doing any violence at all. All of the enemy have been already slain by Krishna. He saw that in the 11th chapter. It's when he saw the universal form. So their death is already ordained, and Arjuna can choose to be the instrument of Krishna and benefit in that way, or he can choose not to fight and sin not by fighting, but by refraining from fighting. So this is the idea here, is that Arjuna, remember, he was afraid of committing sin. He was afraid of committing sin by fighting, killing the men, putting the women into the wives and women into trouble because they wouldn't be protected. There would be Varnasankara. And in this way, he would destroy the family traditions, and he didn't want to be implicated in that sin as he saw it. But because this battle is a righteous fight, it is ordained by Krishna, it's desired by Krishna, therefore, the sin is in not fighting, not in fighting. But Arjuna will do that completely selflessly. And the proof is that all of his being, you know, his emotions, his desire, is not to fight on the material platform. He doesn't care about the kingdom now. He certainly wants to see Bhishma and Drona and his relatives alive. So everything is telling him not to fight on the material platform, so there's no question of any fruit of action here when he finally fights. The only reason he's fighting is because Krishna wants him to, and because he realizes that is the highest principle of action, is doing as Krishna wills. So now I'm ready for you to tell us the wonderful thing that happened today. Madhu Mangal G.
Say that it's amazing that you're reading this, because I met a lawyer downtown today, and I was telling him the same thing, and I just couldn't remember where to find it, and he was really sad.
What, the idea that it's proper, capital punishment is proper?
No,
that, was that what you were telling him? Because there's a lot of subject matter.
And that the reason why, because, you know, that he doesn't have to suffer from his next
life. Right, right.
And he just couldn't understand it, but I wanted to get more sort of, and I had the Bhagavad Gita for him, I just couldn't remember where it was.
And now you know, next time you meet a lawyer.
What would you look under in the
index?
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe capital punishment? You can do the research while we go on to the next verse.
Well, it'll be interesting to be able to find.
Yeah, it should be there. I mean, this, but you've got to have the right Gita. If you have that old Gita, it was not going to work. You got one of the new ones? You have a new one there? Sure. If you have an old one, you'll find it. You look like, it looks like old paper to me.
Yeah.
Yep. You got to have the new one. This is the complete index.
Oh, that's.
Yeah, you won't find it there because none of the purports are indexed. Okay, so we're going to move on to this famous text 22. And why don't we chant it in unison since it's so important? See if we can do it. All in unison. Don't wait for me.
Nope, it's not here under capital punishment.
Right. We'll figure that one later. Vasangsi jirnani yata vihaya navani gunnati naroparani tata sharirani vihaya jirnani yangyani sangyati navani dehi. As a person puts on new garments, giving up old ones, the soul similarly accepts new material bodies, giving up the old and useless ones. Purport. Change of body by the atomic individual soul is an accepted fact. Even the modern scientists, who do not believe in the existence of the soul, but at the same time cannot explain the source of energy from the heart, have to accept continuous changes of the body, which appear from childhood to boyhood, and from boyhood to youth, and again from youth to old age. From old age, the change is transferred to another body. This has already been explained in a previous verse, 2:13. Transference of the atomic individual soul to another body is made possible by the grace of the supersoul. The supersoul fulfills the desire of the atomic soul as one friend fulfills the desire of another. The Vedas, like the Mundak Upanishad, as well as the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, compare the soul and the supersoul to two friendly birds sitting on the same tree. One of the birds, the individual atomic soul, is eating the fruit of the tree, and the other bird, Krishna, is simply watching his friend. Of these two birds, although they are the same in quality, one is captivated by the fruits of the material tree, while the other is simply witnessing the activities of his friend. Krishna is the witnessing bird, and Arjuna is the eating bird. Although they are friends, one is still the master and the other is the servant. Forgetfulness of this relationship by the atomic soul is the cause of one's changing his position from one tree to another, or from one body to another. The jiva soul is struggling very hard on the tree of the material body. But as soon as he agrees to accept the other bird as the supreme spiritual master, as Arjuna agreed to do by voluntary surrender unto Krishna for instruction, the subordinate bird immediately becomes free from all lamentations. Both the Mundaka Upanishad 3:12 and Shvetashvatara Upanishad 4:7 confirm this. Samane vrikshe purusho nimagno nishaya 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 shochati muhyamanaha jushtam yada pashyat yanyamisham asya mahimanam iti vita shokaha. Although the two birds are in the same tree, the eating bird is fully engrossed with anxiety and moroseness as the enjoyer of the fruits of the tree. But if in some way or other he turns his face to his friend, the Lord, and knows his glories, at once the suffering bird becomes free from all anxieties. Arjuna has now turned his face towards his eternal friend Krishna and is understanding the Bhagavad Gita from him. And thus, hearing from Krishna, he can understand the supreme glories of the Lord and be free from lamentation. Arjuna is advised herewith by the Lord not to lament for the bodily change of his old grandfather and his teacher. He should rather be happy to kill their bodies in the righteous fight so that they may be cleansed at once of all reactions from various bodily activities. One who lays down his life on the sacrificial altar or in the proper battlefield is at once cleansed of bodily reactions and promoted to a higher status of life. So there was no cause for Arjuna's lamentation. So this laying down of the body on the sacrificial altar, we can think of that, you know, what does that mean? Do we perform human sacrifice? Not that I know of. But to engage in sacrifice with every breath for the sake of Krishna, for the sake of the pleasure of the Lord, is just like laying down one's life on the sacrificial altar. We don't need a sacrificial altar to perform sacrifice, especially in this age, with the congregational chanting of the holy name. Every place is a sacrificial altar, right? Wherever you're doing sankirtan, wherever you're preaching, you're sacrificing. So that principle really is applicable to the fully surrendered soul, is that he's sacrificing his personal desires, his separate desires for the sake of the Lord. So this is a very important verse. It gives a very stark analogy for the transmigration of the soul. And as Prabhupada points out, already in the text 13, famous Dehi Nosmanyata Dehi verse, Krishna has given us a wonderful way to intuit the reality of transmigration. In this very body, we're moving from body to body. The change is gradual, so we don't notice it. But it's after some years, you can obviously see that you've completely changed your body and that you're the same person. So if the body changes, but you're the same person, clearly you're not the body. Ergo, you know, QED. So what are we? We are the conscious soul, which is immovable. Now, this is also, this will be mentioned in subsequent verses, that the soul is not only immutable, but he's also immovable. And that's interesting. Let's see. Avyaktoyam achintam avikaryam uchate. Is that immovable? Yes, immutable. Inside, well, can neither be burned. Yes. Text 24. Nityak sarvagatak sthanur. Asthanur means unchangeable or achala. Immovable. Now, how is the soul immovable if he moves from body to body? Right? We're just saying how the soul leaves one body and goes to another. The answer is that the soul is actually beyond time and also beyond place. The movement from one place to another is only a function of the material world. In truth, in the spiritual world, just as there's no time, there's no differentiation of place. That's why Krishna can, you know, like in Bhoma Vrindavan, it's hard to figure how he can traverse the large expanse of the Brajamandala in one day. To go from Krishna Balaram temple to Govardhan Hill requires a 45-minute car drive. How is Krishna walking there every day? The thing is that in the spiritual world, these places expand. Just as time is infinitely malleable, you know, we know from how Brahma, you know, when he stole the calves, for a whole year he was gone, but it was only a second of earth time. So, but Brahma is still in the material world. So when you get to the spiritual world, time becomes infinitely malleable according to the rasa, according to what Krishna needs. So you have the sun coming up, the moon coming up, but there's no real sun, there's no real moon, there's no day, there's no night, as we have it here. But for the lila, we have that. So similarly, a place is also different there. The soul really doesn't go anywhere. We haven't gone anywhere. We haven't left the spiritual world in one sense. We're still there. But we're sleeping. We're dreaming. We're in the material world. Because we want to forget Krishna. We want to enjoy separate from him. And that's the disease of the soul. So what happens when we die? It means that the mind, that this material contraption that we're in right now becomes unserviceable. And so the subtle body carries the mind. You know, again, it's used this. It means the body falls away and the mind becomes focused on another body, in this case, another body in a womb somewhere, and you start developing that and you're within the heart, as it were. But in one sense, we don't go anywhere. The soul is immovable. It doesn't travel the way a body will go from one place to another. But to think about transmigration, it's very hard to think about it other than going from one body to another, one body to another. So that's the language we use. Just like we use the language of falling from the spiritual world, but in one sense we haven't fallen. Well, Prabhupada explains that in a wonderful essay called the Crow and Tal Fruit Letter, it's called. It's not really a letter. In which he talks about that process of falling from the spiritual world. Really, he says there is that we simply are dreaming. And that after all of these millions and millions of births in this world, which have taken millions and millions and millions of years of earth time, it will seem just like the snap of a finger when we finally wake up to our life in this kingdom of God. It's very wonderful. So, the Mudnuka Upanishad, the two souls in the tree, in the tree of the body. This comes up not only in the Mundaka Upanishad and the Shvetarashtra Upanishad, but in our very own Srimad Bhagavat Purana, namely Bhagavatam. There's two living entities in the tree of the body. This is said very distinctly in the 13th chapter, Chetra Gim Chap Imam Vidhi Sarva Chetra Shubharata. Chetra Chetra Yogyanam Yutta Gyanam Atangamam. The first element of knowledge is to understand the souls in the body, the matter, spirit, and the controller of both. Remember that phrase, matter, spirit, and the controller of both. So matter is the body and the external matter. The spirit is the individual soul, and the controller of both is the super soul. So the super soul's function, he's deputed by Krishna, an expansion of Krishna in the heart, and he oversees the activities of the individual soul, provides intelligence so we can fulfill our karma. He understands the desires and fulfills them as we are due them. Sometimes we may desire something like anything, but we don't get it because it's not part of what we do due to our karma. So he serves as kind of an order supplier for the soul. So this is not the proper relationship of the soul and Krishna. This is the diseased relationship. Krishna accompanies us out of our kindness and compassion to try to teach us to give up the fruitless effort of trying to enjoy the fruits of this material body, sense gratification. And the observing bird, if you will, the super soul, he's never entangled. He's not involved in the whole thing. He's simply witnessing this. But he has his desire, and that desire is that the soul will turn to him. So when the soul turns to the super soul, not directly, but through the medium of the realized spiritual master, the sadhus, and the shastra, we're turning to super soul right now. When we read Bhagavad Gita, these are the same words that the super soul is teaching us through as Krishna himself, externally. Eventually we can access that directly. But ultimately, we're not out to realize the super soul, we're out to realize a relationship with Krishna. So when we turn to the super soul means when we start listening to what the super soul desires, rather than giving requests, constant requests to the super soul, then that's the beginning of our devotional life. So we're struggling very hard. The soul has to struggle hard to maintain the charade of independence from the Lord. Maintaining this body, thinking it's ourselves, fighting with the material energy, trying to eke out some pleasure and security, and again, life after life, being defeated because the material energy is impossible to cross over until we surrender to the Lord. So when the super soul out of compassion is trying to teach us, and when we finally listen, then we can become liberated from this battle of birth and death. So because it's just like an old coat. Therefore, Arjuna should rejoice in killing the old body of Bhishma and Drona. They're sure to get new bodies and good ones too, because they're pious souls, great devotees actually. So there's no lament. Arjuna should stop lamenting. This is part of the theme of this section of Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, "Ashochanam ashochastram." You're lamenting for what is not lamentable. So stop this lamentation, which is simply the function of the Shudras, and fight for the sake of fighting. Fight for my sake. You won't be entangled. Okay, any discussion on this nice verse? Definitely a memorable verse. Padmavati?
You just threw in a couple of words there. What are they? Words are later. Ergo QED.
Yes. You never took logic in school?
I guess not.
Or how about geometry?
Yeah, I did, but that was horrible.
Yeah. You're probably blocking it out. QED, at the end of a proof, you put QED. I don't know what it stands for in Latin, if any of you can know. But it's Latin. It means thus it is proved. Ergo is another way of saying therefore. That's all. Ergo simply means therefore.
Amara?
Yeah, thus it is proved.
You were saying that the soul doesn't go anywhere. So what about these people that practice astral projection? They go to Tokyo, they can go to the next room, they can...
Yes. What does it mean to go? In other words, they're seeing what's there in Tokyo, right? They're getting the sense of movement. Oh, we certainly get the sense of going from one place to another. But in a higher sense, the soul doesn't go anywhere. Because
the soul, when they're traveling like that to different places,
the point is that in one sense, you can say the soul is going, and then there's the silver cord, right? It keeps that tied to the body so that they can come back to the body. Yeah, I mean, there's all of that imagery and that understanding, but what do we do with this statement here that the soul doesn't move? Achalo. You know, he's not, in one sense he's going, but in another sense he's not going anywhere. Because the soul is in truth, doesn't have anything to do with the body. The soul is always aloof from the body. He doesn't mix. We don't mix with matter. We seem to, because of the false ego and the attachment of the subtle body filled with all kinds of identifications with this body. So when the feet are walking, you know, we seem to be going around the block and from here to there, you know. But in truth, we're immovable. We're simply identifying ourselves with different configurations of matter. But actually, we don't go anywhere. Achala. We haven't even left the spiritual world. I mean, the spiritual world is described as beyond, you know, the realm of Brahma through the eight coverings of the universe, way far away, right? We have to go home, back to Godhead. But as it said, Goloka Vrindavan is all pervading. Krishna is in our heart. Wherever there is Krishna, there is also Radha. There is also the gopis, the cows, the gopis. The whole Vrindavan Dham is there in the heart. What does that mean? It's a chincha. It's inconceivable. You're going far means you're transforming your consciousness radically. That's the real content of.
People don't understand because even if there's a time of death, I don't know where, you spend different places that the soul leaves the body.
I know. But then you have to reconcile it with this achaloyam sanatana. It's inconceivable. It's just like inconceivable. Krishna is far away, yet he's very close. He walks, but he doesn't walk. You know, so there's also, I mean, we're coming on this verse, Ashchaya Bhat Pashyati Kashchidainam. The soul is amazing. Even when hearing about the soul, you can't see. This is one of the amazing things about the soul. He go from body to body all over the universe, wandering all over the universe. It doesn't move anywhere. Achaloyam stanatam. Pretty amazing, huh? Yes, John.
So this, to be said that I guess it's in Western psychology, they say the conscience.
Yeah.
Is that like, what's our view on that? Is that like the super?
The conscience, yeah, the conscience is sometimes identified. I think we find that in somewhere in Prabhupada's books, that this is the voice of the super soul, faintly heard.
People know, like, something's bad.
You know, intuitively, you do something. You know, it's, in other words, you know, because we're not. In the, like on the animal or the, you know, the virus, you know, there's no conscience, you know, it's just like jungle, there's no mercy, you know what I mean? The insects, it's just like a total jungle. And but human beings have developed higher. So you intuitively know that even though you want to do something, you know, if you want to steal, you may not even have been taught that, but it's bad. Or if you take something and you stomp on somebody and you punch them in the mouth and you see they're bleeding and crying. There's something in the heart that says, no, this isn't good. You know, I shouldn't be doing this. But that can be covered so much that people don't feel anything. You know, these are like what they call zombies or something. But, you know, trained murderers. You know, the government trains murderers. You know, people that are assassins. You know, they have no, it doesn't bother, they'll kill anyone. You know, and there's no tinge of conscience. So that little voice in there, that's, you know, that can be said to be the super soul. But it's very faint, and you know, it tells different people different things, because you're interpreting it through your mind and through your culture. You know, for most people, they don't care. You'll eat meat. No tinge of conscience. But when you come in touch with Krishna consciousness, or even just, you know, ethical vegetarianism, you know, and you perceive what's going on, you know, and you have a little bit of a sensitivity, empathy, you say, oh, this is horrible. You know, why should I cause all this pain? I don't need that. I mean, I don't need meat to survive. So it's you know, you can see how totally wrong it is. So there, you know, the conscience has been sensitized. You just, you know, someone may not even believe in God, but if they're an ethical vegetarianism, you know, you know. So that's, you know, sensitized. That's like a more sensitive conscience. So, but the full development of the conscience is truly Krishna consciousness, because you're totally sensitized or totally aware of in detail, you know, what the super soul is telling you. And you have a very developed sense of law and ethics according to the Shastra. So when our Krishna conscience is developed so that, you know, we feel bad about doing anything that's not pleasing to Krishna, then that's pure devotion. In one, you know, in one sense, you can develop it up to that. So yes, conscience can be said to be the voice of the super soul trying to reach us. You had something, Chris.
Yeah. That letter you mentioned from Prabhupada, was it called Crow and Tall Fruit?
Yeah.
Crow and
Tall. Would you like me to explain why it's called the Crow and Tall?
That's a whole one.
I spoke on this in Elatra. I gave a talk. I think it was the Sunday feast. Anyway, so the Crow and Tall is one of these little stories that has a point, you know, with a moral to it. And the moral to this story is, don't get entangled in useless argument. You know. So here's the story. One day, the Tal, you know, we know from the Talavan. The Talavan, I don't know if you remember the story of Dhenukasura, or Dhenukasura. You probably heard of it, but you just don't. Is where Krishna and Balaram went into the forest and they killed these asses by swinging them around. Maybe you haven't heard that one yet. We had it in the class here. So there's a kind of fruit called a tal fruit. I've never tasted it. Apparently it's very tasty and juicy. It grows in India somewhere. So there was this tall tree hanging with nice ripe fruits hanging. And these two gentlemen were sitting near the tree. And they each fancied themselves logicians, philosophers. And suddenly a black bird, a crow, comes down and lands on the branch where one of the tall fruits is hanging. And a minute later, the fruit falls, and simultaneously, the crow flies off. So the question is, did the fruit fall and move the branch and scare the bird that he flew off? Or did the birds, you know, flying and therefore agitating the branch a little bit, cause the fruit to fall down? Which is, this is the deep philosophical question. So one of the men said, just see, the ripe fruit happened to fall and move that branch a little bit, scared the bird and flew away. And the other said, no, you're absolutely wrong. I saw it with my own eyes. The bird moved that branch a little bit, caused the fruit to fall, and that was the effect, not the cause of the birds flying. So which is the cause, which is the effect? And they spent the whole day arguing like that. So now the point of Prabhupada including that in the letter is this, is that because it had already been a fact that in his Krishna Conscious Society, this letter was written like 1972 or something like that. The question of the fall of the jiva from the spiritual world had come up. How did we fall? Did we fall? It says right in the Gita, once going, you never come back. If we were there enjoying with Krishna unlimited bliss, ananda, why would we ever leave? You see? Maybe we came from the Brahma Jyoti, where there's not that kind of bliss, you know. And there was some indication in Prabhupada's books where he says, you know, no one ever falls from Vaikuntha. And in the Isha Upanishad, it seems to say in one place that the jiva comes from Brahman. So anyway, this argument was going on amongst his disciples. And so one devotee named Madhudvish Das at that time, the old Madhudvish, asked Prabhupada to write something that would definitively answer this question, and he would send it around to different temples. So Prabhupada proceeded to dictate this essay, in which he describes the key phrases, formerly we were with Krishna in his lila or sport. And that's not the only place he mentions that. There's other places, fourth canto I can show you, where we were with Krishna, you know, enjoying with him, and somehow or other, and there's no other explanation, somehow or other, you know, we developed a desire to compete with Krishna rather than to serve him. And as soon as that desire bubbled up, Maya grabbed us, and we left the spiritual world. But Prabhupada explains that really, in truth, what's happening is that we're covered and we're dreaming. It's a big dream. This comes up again and again in Bhagavatam. The material world as a dream. And that we're dreaming with the body, we're dreaming we're Americans, we're dreaming. All of this stuff is a dream. And it's no more substantial than a dream. It just comes and goes. You can see it with the body. And even within each body, there's so many things that are like. So similarly, the whole thing is a dream. And we're really with Krishna, but we're forgetting that we're with Krishna. We're thinking we're dreaming with this body and dreaming so many bodies. When we wake up from that dream, by the process of Krishna consciousness, it will be just a second that we'll be feel like we're separated from Krishna. So that's what falling from the spiritual world means. In one sense, we don't fall. We're with Krishna. But that forgetting of Krishna, forgetting of our service attitude, that constitutes falling from the spiritual world. I also wrote a little something that condenses this whole thing. Yeah.
I was going to say, it sounds satanic, because that's what Satan is from, because he was with God, wanted to compete. And God says no, and he threw him out of heaven.
We're all little Satans.
Well, that's what it sounds like.
Thank you for that. On that note, really,
I'll try to find the source.
All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Is that on the database?
One second.